I'm Andrew Murata, host of the Education Leadership and Beyond podcast, a part of the Education Podcast Network, just like the show you are listening to now. Shows on the network are individually owned and opinions expressed may not reflect others. Find other interesting education podcasts at edupodcastnetwork.com.
Hey, welcome back. Steve here, and today I'm talking with Christopher Lorig. He is a decorated, retired U.S. Naval commander. He is also the author of a sci-fi military thriller called SESG Explorer. Oh, this is an awesome talk. Engaging thriller. You're going to love this. Thanks for listening. Oh, by the way, before you go, it'd be so cool if you took time to help out the podcast. And I got a few suggestions. One would be you could tell a friend and share the links. Another would be go to my website and leave a review and subscribe. And how about this one? Click on the link on my website homepage that says Buy Me a Coffee. And by doing this, you could donate a dollar or two to help me address the costs associated with producing the podcast. That would be cool. Thanks for thinking about this. You are awesome. Enjoy the show.
When I finally started to write SESG Explorer, I was actually deployed to Iraq in 2006. So my downtime, I just went started banging out a story on my laptop.
It's the Education Podcast, your favorite show, with lots of groovy guests and they share what they know. So crank it up to 10 and let your neighbors know that here's another show with Dr. Steve Miletto. Teaching, learning, leading K-12. Teaching, learning, leading K-12. Teaching, learning, leading K-12. With Dr. Steve Miletto.
Christopher Lorig served as a United States Navy officer and retired as a commander with a year-long deployment in Iraq during a military career that spanned 28 years. He is also a science fiction military writer who has penned his debut novel, SESG Explorer. Lorig's last assignment included at the outset of the COVID pandemic, having served NATO at the headquarters of Supreme Allied Command Transformation. He was awarded, honored, and recognized with the government for his years of hard work, including Defense Meritorious Service Medal, 4 awards, Meritorious Service Medal, 2 awards, Navy and Marine Corps Commendation Medal, 4 awards, Navy Unit Commendation Award, Navy Meritorious Unit Commendation Award, Fleet Marine Force Ribbon, National Defense Service Medal, 2 awards, Armed Forces Expeditionary Medal, Iraqi Campaign Medal with EGA Bronze Star, Global War on Terrorism Service Medal, Korean Defense Service Medal, Humanitarian Service Medal, Overseas Service Ribbon, and U.S. Navy Rifle Expert and Navy Pistol Expert. He earned a BBA in Finance and an MBA from the University of Oklahoma. He received another Master's in National Security and Strategic Studies from the Naval War College. Born and raised in Oklahoma, he also had brief stints in Long Beach, California, and Daytona Beach, Florida. His military service took him to Japan, South Korea, Iraq, Guam, and Germany, as well as to Virginia, Rhode Island, Nebraska, Minnesota, Washington, and California. He brings an international and military perspective to his writings. He resides in Jellicoe, Tennessee. He looks forward to the day that man settles on Mars and expands to the rest of the solar system. Our focus today is Christopher's novel, SESG Explorer. A little bit about the book. The United States has sent a fleet of ships on a diplomatic mission, traveling to a planet they received a message from. They meet the people of Camorriga and discover that they are seeking new worlds to conquer. They discover just how dangerous the galaxy truly is. SESG Explorer aims to be a space adventure action thriller. Christopher, thanks so much for joining the show, and say hi to everyone.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me on. Glad to be here.
Well, glad you're here. And before we talk about your book, let's talk about you as an officer in the U.S. Navy. Thank you for your service, and why'd you serve?
Oh. Well, that's the first time I got asked that question. Why did I serve? Always a burning desire to serve in the military. Not necessarily a career, but just growing up, the adventure of it all, really. Going to see the world, willing to fight for our Constitution, our Republic. But yeah, it's just that I just had a deep desire to serve in the military. And I chose the Navy partially because I don't have 20/20 vision. So the Air Force was kind of out as far as being a pilot and not to be a naval aviator. But I saw it as the best chance to see the world and experience other cultures and other peoples. And still, it's a technical area. So yeah, that's in a nutshell why I desire to serve.
Very cool. And I understand. I do understand. And that's cool. As, you know, as a former communications in the Army and Army National Guard and Reserves, it's one of the things that desire to serve the country was mine. And it's, and by the way, getting to do cool stuff. But for some reason, when I was in high school, the Navy kept wanting me to get into submarines. They kept coming after me. I don't know what told them that I needed to be in submarines, but I was like, no. I need land, okay? But yeah. Good stuff. Thanks for talking about that. So what was your original job or entry point in the Navy?
So my first duty station was Naval Hospital Oak Harbor. And I was the general medical administrator at that point. And as I discovered real quick, I didn't want to be in hospitals. I wanted to be operational out in the field. A very good assignment. Learned a lot. Manpower. I started out in the manpower office, but I quickly moved to patient administration, which is actually how a military hospital interacts with patients. Their health records. At that time, hospitals would send people out into town to a civilian hospital. And if we did that, we paid for it. And I was a checkpoint on that. It's also how we, if a patient has an issue with any department, usually the patient administration department has to handle that. So I learned a lot about Navy medicine and medicine in general. And sadly, we were the first assignment or first area of the country, Washington and Oregon State, to receive TRICARE. And we had to work through some of that. And thankfully, I was there because they were going to make military member a subsidized group of the new health insurance. And I really pushed hard for our negotiators to understand, don't make military subsidized. We have to be at the top, TRICARE Prime, as we call it. So I had to educate the other officers because their education was not in business. It was in public health. So I had to educate them how any subsidized group is at the bottom of the list because a provider of any service will only provide service to those they're getting paid for. And so we made sure the military and the military family was above the retirees. And I'm retired now, so I'm at that lower echelon. But if it's a military hospital serving military population for military readiness and combat readiness, they need to be service first in the military hospital. And that's how that came about. But that was my entry point. And like I said, I quickly discovered hospitals weren't for me. So I was assigned next to a Naval Reserve Command where we oversaw like 12 and a half states worth of U.S. Navy reserves. And I was one of the few at the duty in the command, which was okay. I learned a lot about the reserves and how they operated. And then my next duty was with the U.S. Marine Corps at Camp Pendleton, First Force Service Support Group, as it was then known. Now it's Marine Logistics Group. And finally, I was operational.
Yay!
And I was able to deploy with the 15th Marine Expeditionary Unit on the Essex R Amphibious Readiness Group, which kind of leads through an evolution when I was at 7th Fleet, again, operational out of Japan, where the title SESG comes from. We created at that time for the Marines and the ARGMU, we added capabilities that created the Expeditionary Strike Group, which added naval firepower to those three ships in support of the U.S. Marines during their various Marine Expeditionary Unit missions. The first letter, S, is for space, because they're going out into deep space. So they're a space expeditionary strike group.
Love it. Love it. Good stuff. And thanks for talking about your entry level into the Navy and so forth, because I can only imagine being in the Navy and wanting to get to ships. can we get there now? Like that. All right. So let's shift to your novel, SESG Explorer. So what inspired you to write it?
Well, as I like to say, my imagination was woken by my dad's reading collection way back when it was, I don't know, 8, 9, 10. He had novels from the 1950s and, of course, Robert A. Heinlein. All that woke in my imagination to futuristic realms and fantasy, because, of course, I found J.R.R. Tolkien and Isaac Asimov. That just really expanded. And I found one to tell stories about what was going on in my head about fantasy and science fiction and people out there. When I finally started to write SESG Explorer, I was actually deployed to Iraq in 2006. So my downtime, I just went started banging out a story on my laptop. And that's where Kevin Brannigan appeared, and Captain Lindsay, and General Connington. And what I wanted to do was highlight the Navy and Marine Corps team. Is, you know, in the military, we have positive and negative experiences like anyone else in any life. But the professionalism, the adaptability, how you have to think your way through problems. The Navy and Marine Corps really did that very well. And I had already come back from my MEU deployment. Now I was with Marine Force, or I was with the Marines again, Marine Expeditionary Force 4 in Al Anbar, Iraq. And there I was serving again with the Marines and even with the Army. We had Army units in our AOR, area responsibility. And that was my focus. But I didn't publish, and I didn't do my edits. And I went on to what we call unified commands, where now I'm with the Army and Air Force as well. And I started learning a lot more about them, not just what I had learned to become an operations officer. Now I'm actually interacting with them. And when I retired, I had to redo my focus on the book. And it's really to highlight the professionalism of the U.S. military. And with that, I had also encountered people from the science and technology fields, research and development. And I wanted to highlight our cooperation with the science disciplines. And I had already worked with an ambassador at Charge d'Affaires, representatives from state. And so, yeah, I don't shine a great positive light on the State Department. And that's because of military reaction or interactions with state over the past 20 years or so, because there was always such a tension between the two departments. They used to work very well together before 1990s, I would say, even 2000. And so I wanted to highlight that. And that was kind of the genesis and it's a long-winded explanation of, I really just want to highlight service, the professionalism of all the departments, the different communities, and if they work well together, how they can overcome any adversity.
Love it.
So I'm hoping for younger people who get a hold of the book, it can inspire them to service in any of those disciplines. It doesn't have to be military. It could be a science discipline or even a diplomatic discipline.
Well, I love it because that's, you know, it comes through with your experiences and such and something like this and your writing. And they, I always get frustrated with whether it's a TV show, a movie, or a, you know, some sort of storylines where, you know, they're writing about something you can tell, yeah, I'm not so sure you've had that type of, even deal with the type of hierarchy that happens for, like what you would describe with a fleet or with the ship's commander and you know, dealing with the different structures that are there. Sometimes I think they need to experience some of that to be able to write about it. So, but awesome. Yeah. So kudos to you with that. And so one of the things that I want to kind of jump into is that, you know, you've kind of hit addressed it a couple of times here is that, you know, your 28 years in the military obviously has some impact on your writing. So let's go there for a minute.
Most definitely. Admiral Brannigan, the main character, he's a compilation of different personalities I've encountered over my service. And his interaction with his wife, because I introduced his wife early on in the book. In fact, she's in chapter one. That's based off of mine and other people's family relations. My wife and I spent 10 years apart due to the naval service. And it was really a consecutive 10 years apart. And I want to hit on the family stress of the military, because I'm not unique in the military in that regard. But there's aspects of admirals and generals that are built into both of my general officers, Admiral Brannigan and Major General Connington. So they're kind of a combination of several different people over the years. But the hierarchy and infrastructure, Colonel Williams, who's commanding officer of the USS Chesty, which carries the Marines in the fleet, he comments how a woman who he dated in his younger years, Captain Josephine Lindsay, is now the operations officer, and how much power she would have in the fleet, because she's really the third in command of the fleet. Nice. Yeah, the Admiral Gerald Connington, and now Captain Lindsay, and he's two steps below that, and actually maybe three, if you consider Colonel Roberts, who's in charge of the Marine Expeditionary Unit that's going on. So he kind of bounces down, and he recognizes that. I use that to try and express the hierarchy and some of the relationships of the military in action.
And that's awesome. And that's one of those where hopefully she has a short memory about whatever.
Well, I don't really delve into that, because the focus isn't on any of that personal relationship. It's on really how the fleet's going to deal with their first encounters of different species out there.
That's cool.
But yes, there can be that real tension in the military. And it's not that we don't allow personal relationships on an intimate level, but there's some fine lines you have to walk. And in chapter one, I highlight that the first commander of SESG Explorer was relieved for cause. And the reason was he was having an inappropriate affair with his own aide. So that's a reality too. That breaks down morale, discipline, and order. And it's why Admiral Brannigan's brought in to replace that commander. And he has a reputation of following more of those regulations of good order and discipline. But no, Blue Ink Review actually made the comments a captivating read with engaging characters. And it's because of my experience in the military that I think you have that level of engagement with people in the book.
Oh, definitely. It feels real. It feels real interactions. And we may not be at that level of going out into space, but everything else, it makes it, you know, you feel that experience coming through in the interaction of the people. And that's what, is awesome. One of the things I was amazed about in the military is how small the world could be suddenly, where I'm standing in line getting dry cleaning and I hear this name mentioned by the dry cleaner in front of me in this line. And I'm like, oh, there's can only be like one guy in the world is named that. And I look around and I'd gone to high school with him. And we said, so after we both got our dry cleaning, he was getting new signature, the tapes of your name that go on your uniform. And I said, and so we ended up chit chatting. We hadn't seen each other in 10 years, you know, it's like, and we just come together in line in the army, in a dry cleaners on the same base. And I just know that, you know, part of what you talk about is they start feeling real, the type of thing where you're talking to them and the different experiences they might have. So sorry, I was mentioning that about how small that world could be. So,
and no, you're right. I was a Pacific Navy guy. And when I say that, if you don't know the military, you may have the Navy, but there's East Coast Navy, West Coast Navy, just like East Coast Marines, West Coast Marines. I'm sure it's the same with the Army. And then we had the Pineapple Fleet, the Japanese Fleet, as we call it. And then, you know, it's a community. And I started out in the Pacific, Washington State, San Diego, or Camp Pendleton, rather. And 7th Fleet is out of Japan. So, and one of my other duty stations was on Guam, where I met my wife. So I'm a Pacific guy. And then I go to Command Staff School on the East Coast, a couple other assignments. So when I went back to the Pacific, when I was assigned to U.S. Forces Korea in South Korea, people are like, hey, welcome back. It's good to see you because of my reputation. And I guess I don't really talk. Well, in the first chapter, there's reputations being discussed by three general officers. Well,
nice.
Yeah, three general officers about five candidates for the command of SESG Explorer. And in chapter two, General Connington's having a discussion with the carrier air group commander, Colonel Cole, another Space Force officer, about Admiral Brannigan. Why is he in charge? And Connington says, hey, I've looked him up. This guy is spot on. We're lucky to have him.
Cool. I love it. I got to get you to, as we're talking here, can we take a time out and just could you do your own commercial for your story to, you know, why should they read it?
So Earth receives from deep space, a trip onto a message from deep space in finding contact, but there's gaps of technology in the message. So they decide, instead of responding to the message with a like message, they would send out a fleet of ships to make first contact and try and make diplomat relations. But as with all things in life, nothing goes as planned, and it turns into a fight for survival for the crew of the expedition, SESG Explorer.
Very nice. I love it. All right. So before we go back into your story, let's talk about writing for a minute. Do you outline?
I started outlining. I was taught always to outline back in my college days, write an outline. And at the War College, when I was writing outline, but I didn't do an outline when I started SESG Explorer. I just started typing. But I see the gaps and holes in doing that, because when I went back to bring it up to speed with Space Force being created, I had to go an outline. And I ran into some problems where I actually outlined a chapter. And I'm almost done with Minerva, the follow-on book, and I definitely did an outline for that. And I find when I run into problems, I need to delve into the chapter itself and do an outline. But it was really character development. I found I needed to do some work. And when I redid SCSG Explorer, I actually developed some background with Admiral Brannigan, because right off the bat, I'm telling his life story. I mean, in chapter one, he has a nightmare over events when he was signed in the Sudan with the UN. And so I had to look at his career. And General Connington, I had to look at his career, and Captain Lindsay. And then there's Captain Karen Smith, the commander of the USS Intrepid. And it's like, well, why would she be the commanding officer of the flagship? Yeah. Do I delve into that in the book? No, not totally, but I found it very useful to have developed the characters before writing. And I noticed characters would just invent themselves during the writing. I had to write down their names and who are these people that keep coming into the story? But no, I've started outlining each book.
Gotcha. Nice. Yeah. So since we're talking about writing just a minute, and one of the things that you know that I'm always fascinated about is how do you get past the blank page? I mean, how do you, do you ever get stuck and then try and figure out how to get out of it?
Yeah, I go mow the property. Actually, yesterday while I was mowing the lower third of my property, we have been blessed. We have a 7.5 acre plot of land. A short story came to mind, and right off the bat, First Lieutenant Sean Pierre steps out of an elevator.
Nice.
So when I get a break, I'm going to be writing what happens to him and his team.
Very cool.
But I find that I work through solutions actually when I'm driving or when I'm mowing. If I'm using the chainsaw, my mind's on the chainsaw where that tree's going to fall.
Yeah, makes sense, right? Don't daydream there. That's not good. Yeah, that could be a little dangerous. Nice. All right. So, this is cool because you took me to an area that I was at some point going to ask you about your characters and expanding them and all of that and where they came from. I mean, are any of them kind of like combinations of people that you knew or ran into how are you creating those characters?
Well, their names just kind of appear. Actually, I was in church and my wife noticed that the program, the pastor's preaching, and next thing she notices, I turn over, I write down two names and ranks. And she's like, what are you doing? You're in church. Nice. You're writing your book. And these are two people that will appear in the third book of the trilogy. Two other books will follow us, SCSG Explorer. And I'm writing down the name of a chief of staff to Admiral Brannigan. So their name just appears. And then I start to fill in a bit of their history. As like the chief of staff, she's going to be U.S. Army with experience. That why would Kevin Brannigan choose her to be his chief of staff? And if you know what a chief of staff does, you'll know that's a very important position to a commander, is they have a lot of influence and they have to guide the planning staff, the command staff, into what the commander wants them to do. If you have a weak staff, chief of staff, your people will be all over the place and they'll never meet any of the deadlines or objectives. But if you have a strong, organized chief of staff who can lead, then you're going to get quality products that will enable the commander to make good decisions, good informed decisions. So having that background, yes, I'm going to look at, I've had a bad chief of staff at one command. I've had a couple of excellent chief of staffs at another command. And it's off of my interactions with them, as well as really good operations officers. U.S. Forces Korea and U.S. Africa Command, I had some really good operations officers who worked for the general, and I interacted with them. And Captain Josephine Lindsay is based off of those high quality officers that I've been blessed to work with. So yes, they are a combination of people. I take the qualities and I'll even take the bad qualities. In Minerva, I have a person that has some negative qualities to them based off of people I have interacted with.
Cool.
Can you identify them by name? No.
Smart.
That's why it's in the science, it's in the futuristic realm in deep space. So you can't identify any particular person I may have interacted with.
I like that. Yes.
I protect the innocent and even the guilty.
Nice. Nice. All right. You know, one of the things that I want to make sure we talk about is your sci-fi military thriller. You know, it revolves around humanity's first encounter with an alien race. Think we'll ever make contact one day? I mean, we do have Space Force now.
We do. I don't think Space Force is properly aligned. But again, I think we have hit a point where the U.S. military needs to be restructured. We have band-aided things since the early 2000s. With the National Defense Authorization Act, we're not looking at our strategy right. We're not looking at our military strategy right. And we're not looking at our budget right. And for the Navy to drop high school as a qualification to join because they can't meet recruiting goals, I think is a major mistake. Just because you can't meet a goal doesn't mean you drop the requirement. Maybe you need to look at what you're doing, or maybe you should partner with somebody like Department of Education to see how you can improve the students to meet those goals and that desire of service to nation. But to answer your question, Dr. Frank Drake, I came across him through my research on doing the books. He created a formula in University of Nottingham. Yes, I wrote down my references. They used the formula and estimate there's 30 plus alien civilizations that could exist. So if they're correct, it's only going to be a matter of time we actually do make first contact, and maybe we already have, according to several different groups out there, we already have. And it's even rumored President Eisenhower signed a treaty with an alien race. Rumored, I can't confirm it or deny it because I really don't know. And even if I did know, I probably couldn't confirm it anyway. But yes, we're going to, as soon as we get the technology, we're leaving the planet and we're leaving our solar system. It's technology. It's not the desire. It's the technology that keeps us from going. And once we figure out where to go and we have the means, yeah, I think we will encounter somebody or something. How it turns out depends on motivation of whoever we meet, our motivation for going, and then the ability to communicate without tripping it up and making a mistake. So either we'll have a positive trade diplomat relationship, or we're going to have an interstellar war.
Right. Nice. Hey, that's a scary thought right there. Yes. A misinterpretation of one of the, you know, the they do the wave differently or something. I don't know. You know, it's like, oh, that's not good. Good, this is good stuff, and it's interesting thinking about it. I mean, because especially with, you have Elon out there launching these giant rockets in the air and trying to land them, and obviously he's not personally, but he has his goals set on mind, and, you know, you have to have stuff like that going on in order to get, you know, to make the technology move forward and start looking for new propulsion systems and how things work. I mean, you know, one of his goals was to make the same rocket that goes up come back down and land, you know, and that's cool, as opposed to just, you know, dumping off in an ocean someplace and hoping it works and trying to land. But he's definitely had his chances to learn from, you know, those mistakes as they do that sort of stuff. But one of the things that's really awesome about what you're talking about, as we try to figure out if we're going to come up with that technology that goes to that next level, is how then it would operate, and I don't mean mechanically. I mean operate around who's in charge of what and who's driving what, and how we would interact if we came in contact with those other civilizations if they are out there. And I think that's a pretty interesting thought right there.
Well, I agree. I do try to explore that to a level, because everything on technology that is in SCSG Explorer, we can actually do today, except a hyperspace drive. We're still working, I believe we're working through the math on what that means to travel through a wormhole type avenue, through a faster than light engine. I'm a military operations guy. I'm a master of business administration. I'm a master of arts. I'm not a master of science or a PhD in this realm. Leave that to the experts to figure that out. But you get the drive. And then you get some form of shielding, some sort of electromagnetic shielding to repel micro asteroids that can rip your ship in half. You know, you have to protect with some sort of energy bubble.
That would be important.
But then what happens when you find new energy sources or alien technology? How do you incorporate that? And in that, Dr. Jack Vance, who's head of the science department for the Admiral, he has a team that works through that. And at one point, he gets so excited, he calls up the Admiral going, "We figured it out. We need to take things offline and do stuff." And the Admiral's like, "Whoa, I could possibly be in combat right now. No, we're not taking anything offline." So when do you actually implement or control that? That's, I touch on that in the book.
Like that.
And in fact, Captain Smith gets a little concerned about her ship over, "Wait a minute, you want to do what with this thing we don't know about?" And the Admiral's like, "Well, we kind of need to figure it out." She's like, "All right, I'll get to work on it." Because she doesn't want a big hole blown into her ship.
I like that. I like that. You know, I've got to ask, because you've got several things that are built into this that are part of the real world, and you're focusing on space, but at the same time are still part of our world that you've built around. Do you have any kind of, whether on purpose hidden or kind of themes that you've built into it, that are some things that you want to make sure the reader kind of at some point picks up on, like just how people interact or possibilities of how they might interact or anything, like, you know, some thoughts that you have?
The book touches a little bit on secure borders. For instance, General Order Number 1 to the Admiral and everybody is never let Earth's location be known, no matter what. Our location in this galaxy is to remain hidden. And sub part of that general order, self-destruct your ship before you get captured where that info could be let loose or let out. So that deals with border and border controls. I highlight a moral issue that deals with legal authorities and the ability to enforce it, and that's slave trade, which is very much alive and well in today's world. Sadly, in our own country, as well as in countries all over the place, and they encounter a slave market. And the gallery is actually based off of what I saw in South Korea. But research I've done and things I've seen, it happens here in our own country. And they run into that as, okay, what do we do about this? And they have to work kind of through what do, if they do anything. And if you disrupt the slave trade, history shows you better have a plan to fill, to backfill that. The British general, Charles Gordon, brought down the slave trade in the Sudan in the 1800s, but it caused an economic devastation and he had no plan what to do about it. It's just like, okay, we're anti-slavery. They killed the slavery or slave trade. And now you had an economic disparity occur that led to extremists. The Mahdi rose and he attacked Egypt. And now Gordon had to go back in to deal with the Mahdi. And while he dies, the British then sends a force, and twice their square was broken. That's a historical event, major military event, where the Mahdi and his forces could break the British square, which Napoleon could not break the British square. So, you know, that's a lot of fighting capability, but that disrupted Egypt and Sudan. We saw that in Afghanistan. What do you have to backfill that? So there's some real, well, I'm anti-slavery, and I really want to bring that out, because I really point that out. But then what's your ethical, legal, moral, military, law enforcement abilities to do that? And what do you do after that? They encounter that, they have to deal with it. And in the second book, in Minerva, I finish up on that particular item as well. But that's actually also seen once they get to the planet Gomorrah, and what they find out is happening on Gomorrah. That really helps to make some decision points for the Admiral, because he hits certain decision gates that he has to decide what is he going to do and whether or not a diplomatic relation is even viable. So you read that in the book as well. So outside of that, it goes to our foreign relations. How do we work with other nations? And what are those decision gates that you encounter? So I think we hit foreign relations, slave trade, border, all of those factors that are on our planet that should make one think about, what do we want as a nation? How do we want to interact with nations? And therefore, it goes to that, well, I hope I can inspire in our younger people about service to nation, be it military, science, or the diplomatic corps. As we all have an individual talent that we can actually improve our relations with other nations. You know, in the end, I don't think it's climate change that could kill the human race. I think it's us lobbing nuclear weapons at each other that can do it. And while I'm not anti-war, I prefer a peaceful diplomatic solution over going into combat. Yeah.
makes perfect sense that it does. You know, one of the things that you, you're just kind of sort of talking about here. It's kind of on the outskirts of this. So let's go back into the future and so forth. What do you think? In recent times, we actually had a shot go up. The whole point was to see if they could break up an asteroid. I'm surprised we didn't pay heavily for that, like with it bouncing off of this, off of that, off another thing, and then suddenly it's, you know, new parking lot down in, somewhere in the south end of the country or something. But what do you think about it? The idea that all of a sudden something else shows up in our atmosphere or in our, you know, the idea that we have to deal with an invasion or something. What do you think?
You have two actual real issues. U.S. Strategic Command was the command that was given an assignment, and the Navy was the one that launched the missile off the ship to destroy a U.S. satellite that was in decaying orbit. And we were successful. STRATCOM did everything right on that. The Navy did the trajectory shot right, and we did that. China tried it, and they screwed it up. And thankfully, the satellite fell in the Pacific Ocean, but it created an atmospheric problem, and it had released some toxins. So you have to get it right, and you have to test it. And I'm kind of with you, shooting at big rocks with little missiles can have unintended consequences. And that's where Space Force and getting Space Force right will help. As far as somebody just showing up and scaring the daylights out of us, I had three general courses of actions that could occur. They're hostile and they attack. And that would be their dumbest thing to do, because if anything's going to pull us together, it's an external force attacking the planet. And people are going to say, all right, time to work together, put aside. And when you get mankind motivated, our innovation, our creativity, and our fighting spirit will just come out and they'll gel. Go ahead, attack. You may hurt us, but we'll win the day. The other one shows up and they're totally benevolent, and I think that will cause problems. But it'll be more, we'll take their benevolence, but it could create jealousies between nations. And it's like, well, why are they talking to you and not to me? What makes you special and not me? And now suddenly we go to war against each other. The more likely would probably be we're cautious and we enter into some form of trade relation where we both lose, but we both benefit. And if it's done properly, we can avoid jealousies and envy. And actually, and that's really what I meant, was envy, not jealousy. Jealousy would be, okay, I have my trade agreement. I don't want you getting it. And when you look at the political nature of most countries, they're realists and they're pragmatic, and they don't believe in a win-win. They believe in win-lose. And even though they may be winning, if you're not losing, in their mind, they're losing. So we really... And the UN is not the body that can do this. In fact, I think the UN has lost their general direction and guidance. But what nation will have the maturity to be able to guide the rest of the world to do a proper trade relationship where, no, we all have to win in this one, or else everybody loses. And we don't want that.
Good point. That's
the tough thing to really work out. I don't think it's the intelligent life form coming to us that will be the problem. I think it'll be our own problems.
You know, what was that movie they remade, but it was from the 50s with Klaatu, I think, was the...
The Day the Earth Stood Still.
Yes, and yeah, they shoot at the robot, whatever you're going to call him, the android, and that was a big mistake, you know.
Well, And really, what was the message? That one with Keanu Reeves, I didn't like the remake because it's like, oh, you humans are destroying the world, so we're going to wipe out the humans and give it back to everything else. Whereas Klaatu's message is, you guys have advanced technology now, the nuclear vision, and you can actually come out into the galaxy. You can leave with nuclear technology. You can leave your system. Well, you better figure out how to be peaceful. Otherwise, we're going to wipe you out before you can come out and cause problems for us. Pretty much, rise in your maturity level of global cooperation. And that's a good idea. I mean, it's a great goal. But can we get there as a human species?
Right now, that's quite questionable. You know, all right, so you've mentioned a couple times that this is a trilogy. So the immediate one coming up is Minerva. What's next? When's that coming out?
I just made a deal with the publisher. I have to reattack. I actually have it completed, but I found I have to reattack two chapters. One of them deals with the Admiral in particular, because in it, he's actually working on global destruction.
Nice.
And I figured out, I forgot the emotional impact it'll have on him and the moral dilemma. So I'm reattacking that. And that one should be done in the next day or two. And when I went back to do the timeline, because one of the things that I found with SCSG Explorer was something I learned about J.R.R. Tolkien, The Lord of the Rings. When he wrote The Lord of the Rings, he screwed up his time. And the publisher told him, you have action occurring that you say is in the summer, but it's in the winter. So I had to do that timeline. And when I was working on the timeline for Minerva, I realized it was over a year long, the book is. And the last chapter, I leave a question mark open about a space station. So I had to reattack that. This is mid-April. If I put the nose to the grindstone, I should have it to the publisher by the end of the month. And hopefully by the end of the year, Minerva will be out.
Very cool. So we're around just around the corner for that. Awesome.
And I already have the outline for the third book, the general outline. And like I said, two new characters are coming in. And I've been working out three chapters in my head that I need to. I've got to concentrate on Minerva. But as soon as that's done, you know, and meanwhile, I have these short stories that keep popping up.
Nice.
Lieutenant Sean Pierre comes out of nowhere going, talk about me.
Nice. I was going to say, it sounds like you're starting to have some competing forces happening here on your own. That's whoa, focus. Go away. Not yet. All right.
Exactly. Let me make a note for you.
I like that.
Actually, I do have a little book where this one should be. Yeah, here it is. Oh, yeah, I saw Markham. He appeared and said, write about me, Captain Markham. So I tried to make notes for these guys because I have a fighter lieutenant that for the Knoxville Writers Guild review, they wanted short stories for the review. And it's like, okay, hey. This pilot just popped into my head, so nice. I wrote about her.
Nice.
Submitted that to the review.
That's cool. That's cool. Does your wife understand these conversations that you have with your characters out there?
It's amazing that we're married because our first date. I don't like wasting my time when I'm on dates. is this a relationship or not? So our first date, I just kind of revealed more or less who I am. And she's like, you're weird. But she went out with me on a second date and voila, we're married.
Cool. So
she's like, yeah, he's strange. Let him be. It's like, leave me alone. When I finally get into the solo on the keyboard, leave me alone. Leave me alone. I gotta get this story out.
That's funny. Nice.
But yeah, she read the book and she's like, because she worked as a civilian for the Department of the Army. She's like, no, really, I'm telling you, this is the way a boardroom looks. This is the way they actually hold briefs.
Cool.
This is, I've been there. It's there.
That's cool. It's always nice to have someone who understands a little bit of what your world is right there. That's a good stuff. As we're bringing things to a close, if someone wanted to follow up, Christopher, and connect with you, find out more, where would you send them?
ChristopherLorick.com. That's my website. I have a little bit about me. I have the events that are coming up and interviews and how you can get the book. And I put a status of Minerva on there as well. So they can send through the contact us or contact me. They can shoot me an email if they like. Still working on that. The email is up and all that. I'm just trying to figure out how to get that ping when somebody sends me an email to make sure I go and look at it. That's to my Christopher Lorick email, not the other email that I use for the underlying business and so forth.
Gotcha. Now, when I went to your website, one of the cool things that I saw a couple events coming up, and one of them, you're going to be at a sci-fi event in July. I was looking to see how close, if I might be able to come show up and say, I don't know if you remember me or not.
Yeah, that's July 12th through 14th is the Fanboy Comic Con at the Knoxville Convention Center here in Knoxville, Tennessee. 3-day event. That'll be fun. The fun part is actually interacting with the fans and people that are interested, especially when they buy the book. I'm really excited.
Nice.
But no, we went to the Fanboy Anime, and that was the first time they did anime, and it's very specific, whereas Comic-Con is more open with all the genres. But that was fun, and we got to meet some really interesting folks, other vendors as well as fans. That was really enjoyable, and enjoyable speaking with a lot of people. So we're excited and we're looking forward to the one in July as well. I mean, yeah, maybe 3 days, but should be 3 days of fun.
I would think so. I would think so. That's it might be your people there. All right. We got, because that's definitely, when I was looking at the description of it all, I'm like, that's my people. I got to tell you that. That's cool stuff. So have fun with that. Excellent. We're finishing up, and I got the last two things I want to ask you that are just a little more guest related. Many have ideas about what to write, but their novel never gets finished. What advice have you got for new writers?
Two, and one of them was from another author. I stumbled on it after I had finished SCSG Explorer, but quit editing, quit proofreading. At some point, it's finished. It may not be perfect. That's different. But it comes a day when you're writing it and you're editing and editing, stop and declare finish. The second one is have an editor.
Nice.
Sadly, I had to, after publication, the books that now are on the market are the revised revision one of SCSG Explorer. I discovered a few errors in it, which if somebody else is proofreading other than me, it could have been caught. And I'm not talking a technical editing. I'm speaking about real editing. Another set of eyes. Yes, I can edit. I found it easier to edit in the military what somebody else was writing than editing my own work. And sometimes you get so into the story and the characters that when you read through something, you make an assumption. And it's an unconscious assumption that somebody else reading will catch it. And when my wife was reading it, she goes, the strike group gets to Comorga and the admiral and his diplomat team go down to the planet, you know, Michael Shea, the diplomat, and Admiral Brannigan, they're the two main characters now, and they have a support staff. So they come down and they meet the chancellor of Comorga, and the chancellor's and fights, well, leads them to a greeting ceremony. Well, the next paragraph, the chancellor said, to our greeting ceremony, I'm paraphrasing. In the next paragraph, the admiral is in his room. The wife and a co-worker who bought the book also through her relayed, where's the greeting ceremony? What happened? So I'm like, yeah, okay. So I went back and I wrote the greeting ceremony out, and I had to get that into the book. So now the greeting ceremony is in there, and I make a comment in the book. One of the SEAL team members, and he's thinking it out because he's looking at the Comorgans, and the thing that freaked him out about them were their hands. It really freaked him out about the Comorgan hands. Well, in the greeting ceremony, I described the hands and what they look like. Nice. So that may help the reader now understand why
the
SEALs are freaked out over their hands. Which, if I had an editor before I published, that they probably would have caught that and said, you need to write that.
Like that. Good stuff. Good advice. Last question. Do you have a teacher in your past who made a difference in your life? If so, who was it? And what would you say if given a chance to say thank you?
Yes. Oh, God, what's her name? I actually wrote her a letter years ago. First grade, very hyper kid. And I hate to sit still. I'm always moving. And even when I'm doing public speaking, I'm told I move too much. And it's hard for me even today to stand behind a podium and just stay there. Created some problems for me in Korea with the way you speak in English and your Korean mate translates it. And I edit on the fly, which I found out really is a problem for people translating. You can't do that. But I would act like I was reading, and I would finish in order to do whatever else. And my teacher looked at me and goes, how come you're finished so fast? Oh, I speed read, I said. I mean, this is first grade. I'm 6 years old. And she's like, nope. And so she forced me to give up my playtime outside a recess. I had to stay there and actually read. And that is probably the one teacher that had the greatest impact on my life, because she ensured I learned how to read.
That's cool. I like that. That's awesome. Good stuff. Christopher, thank you so much for sharing your book, SESG Explorer, Contact with Other People, Intrigue, Adventures in Space, Danger. Oh, I love it. Wishing you the best in all you do.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Thank you for having me on your show.
Hey, you have been listening to Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12, a podcast to help you help kids achieve their dreams. Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 is a member of the Education Podcast Network. Podcasts for educators, podcasts by educators. Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 is a member of the podcast network based in Canada called Voice Ed Radio. Voice Ed Radio, your voice is right here. The opinions expressed on Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 are those of the guests and host. Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 is intended to share ideas, advice, and suggestions. Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 is produced for educational purposes. Hey, thanks for listening. It would be awesome if you visited my website at stephenmoletto.com and connected with me, left a review, and listened to more episodes. And by the way, you could also share it with your friends, with your family, and your colleagues. Thanks so much. You're awesome.